The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El-Khoury and today I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Jenkins, who is Secondary Effective Advisor at HFL Education right here in Hertfordshire. Hi, Paul. Thanks for joining us on The Parents Show.
No problem.
It's lovely to have you. Lovely to have you on the show. This is your first time on the show, but of course we've had HFL Education on a few times and we'll be having you on a lot more in the coming years.
We'll see how it goes.
So listen, tell us about your role at HFL and your background.
Well, I've been in education for nearly 30 years. I worked out this morning, which scares me that I'm old enough to say that even. I started as a drama teacher and then worked through various roles. I was head of sixth form, so I dealt with students at A level. There was deputy head and then eventually became a head teacher in the same school that I got my very first job. So it was quite nice.
Oh, lovely.
The full circle. The job I had, my first teaching job interview, became that office became my office. And then after 8 years of being head, I wanted to do something different. So I started working for HFL Education, where I now work with heads all across Hertfordshire, helping them with all aspects of school, from some student-facing stuff to some work about how to improve their exam results and helping them with all sorts of knotty problems that arise. So that's kind of how I ended up in Hertfordshire and in this job.
Brilliant. What a lovely journey.
It's very satisfying to sit there thinking, you know, I got my first teaching job on the day that Tony Blair was elected, start of 1970.
Really?
Great time for education.
Brilliant. Oh, lovely. So this year is a quiet year for me at home because last year my son did his GCSEs, but next year I've got a daughter doing GCSE and a son doing A-levels. So I want to pick your brains about everything to do with this, Paul. So let's start with planning revision. What's the best way to start the ball rolling on revision? Like, I'm talking timetables, purpose, whatever comes to your mind to recommend.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that your kind of starting gun is the mocks. All schools will do some form of mocks. And those are a trial for everybody, including the family and the parents and the students. They're low stakes because they don't count, but they tell you an awful lot. So that's a really important thing, to use that to practice and refine how you as a family respond to that sort of thing. The danger with it sometimes is students just go, oh, well, they're only mocks, they don't count. But actually treating them quite seriously is really important, because if they don't revise, all you learn from the mocks is what you'll get if you don't revise, which is normally not very much. If you revise really hard and get catastrophic results, as heartbreaking as that is, that tells you something very useful. Your revision techniques aren't working. If you revise well, certain things are good, certain things are not. It's a diagnostic. So actually, trying to use the mocks as your first port of call, you as a parent also can be kind of starting to see how your child responds under the pressure of exams. Do they get a bit moody? Do they get a bit fired up by it? Does the stress affect them? And then the other thing is, after they've got their mock results, and that can be, don't just assume that they'll automatically be better in the real thing. And, you know, I was a head teacher for a long time and I used to sit after the mocks and say, no, well, don't worry, you know, as long as you're in school and work hard, every grade will go up by a grade when you come to the real thing. And then I did a statistical analysis and discovered that the mocks for 70% of the students were what they got. So my messaging changed.
That's interesting.
And that was really important. And it actually caused a bit of a seismic shift in our results, because I said, well, do you know what? Don't just assume there's going to be this drift and you'll get better. 70% of you will get what you got then. And if you don't want to be part of the 70%, you need to change what you do. So I think that's really important. So that's your starting point. In terms of having a sort of schedule, you won't be able to have the same sort of schedule for the mocks, because they've still got lessons going on. They're much more compressed than they are in real life. They're not a perfect match, and they don't have the sort of study leave and all that sort of thing. But what you can start to do is get them into patterns and habits. So having a timetable that breaks their subjects down into topics and what we call interleaves them. So you don't do a whole day of history. You're better to do 20 minutes of history, 20 minutes of science, 20 minutes of geography is much better than an hour of geography this day, an hour next time. In terms of time, you shouldn't spend less than 20 minutes. That's not cognitively effective, but you shouldn't spend more than 50 minutes. So actually a child spending 3 hours, what you start doing is unlearning stuff. It's not good for you. So they can put an hour session, give themselves 50 minutes and a 10 minute break. That is much better for them than just plowing through an hour. In terms of timing it, I always suggest that they find 3 slots. And this is a really easy way to do it. So you say you'll do a slot when you get back from school, a slot before your dinner, a slot after your dinner. So imagine they get back from school at 3:30 and you can just start at 20 minutes. So you do 20 minutes when you get back from school, when you mum or dad chats up, says dinner's nearly ready, 20 minutes before dinner, 20 minutes afterwards. They then have time to do the homework because they'll still have homework and have a bit of time off. Guilt-free time off, because that's the trouble, is that when you've got revision to do, it's a bottomless pit. So one extreme, students will work really hard and won't allow themselves that time to go, no, I'm done for today. Now, as you move towards the exam, you can move up that time period up to basically 50 minutes an hour. So imagine if you come home from school at 3:30, you do an hour, 3:30 to 4:30. You then say dinner's at 6, you do 5 till 6, and after dinner you do 7 till 8, that would be 3 hours worth of revision. That would be a massive amount. Obviously, we just do our 50 minutes, take our 10 minute break. But what you've done is you've established those time slots. So you don't have to do them all even. So they might do come back from school, have their juice and cookie, and then do an hour then, and then just do 2 20-minute slots on either side of dinner. So the key is that it's just a little bit of a routine and they tick them off. You know, a little tick list and the, you know, there's real satisfaction when you look at how we motivate ourselves, how dopamine works. And we know this from scrolling on the internet. It's those regular little hits. So a little to-do list, the crazy satisfaction of just ticking off, I've done that, crossing things out, is one way that we reward ourselves for these things. Because the tough thing is revision is boring. There's no getting away from it. When students say, oh, you know, I just find revision very difficult, I always say, no, you find it boring, and it's because it is boring. And unfortunately, some things in life that you have to do are dull.
Yeah.
There's not many people in life that go, brilliant, it's time to go and clean the toilet. Ah, oh, favourite time of the week. But we do them because we know we need to. So, you know, that's how to kind of organise it. There is a difference in different subjects that need to be revised in different ways. So there isn't a one way to do it. And again, if you see your child just always doing the same thing, and we'll talk a bit later about what you call maladaptive revision, stuff they do that feels good but isn't effective. So with maths, it's about practice papers. It's just seeing the same, you know, you have the same topics come up with little twists each time, and it's just doing more of those. So as a school, we used to do, for our maths students, they used to do a paper every week. Every student that came along to the not very sounding, exciting maths paper club, every child that did a maths paper a week from September to the exam passed the exam without fail. So that is just about, there might be bits when they realise they don't understand this and go back, but mainly that's what they needed to do. English, it's a mix of practice and, you know, English literature, that's about learning quotes, but it's not about having 100 quotes. And again, if you see your child just going, oh, you know, I'm up to quote 70, it's about how they use the quotes and their understanding. So to make sure that they don't hook on, learning quotes can be quite satisfying because you can, you know, whether you've got it or not. It's quite black and white. I can recount that quote or not. Whereas actually to be able to talk about the theme of ambition in Macbeth is much more difficult. But for that sort of revision, they might work in pairs. It's absolutely fine to have a friend over, a girlfriend, a boyfriend, a playmate, and go, right, okay, let's just look at 3 exam questions. Let's talk about them. That still counts as a revision as well. And actually, for things like English literature, it's a really good way to develop their understanding. With languages, most students will have one, you know, there's two things really. There's the grammar and there's the vocabulary, your two big things. So again, it's helpful for them to know which one is their weakness and not to work on one at the exclusion of the other, but go, actually, do I need to be better at my tenses or do I need more vocabulary? Humanities is a mix, but again, it can be very alluring in history to just learn more and more and more and more facts. But there is a point where learning more facts won't get you more marks. And science is a blend of them. It's the fact, but it's also the understanding. So weaker revision just focuses on remembering facts, but actually exams test understanding. So you could teach me now how to recite the theory of relativity and I could learn to say it off pat. That doesn't mean I've learnt what the theory of relativity is. And that's where sometimes people go wrong. And a very simple way to think about it is there's only four reasons you don't get any given mark in an exam. The first one is you don't know it. The second one is you couldn't recall it. The third one is you didn't understand it. And the fourth one is you didn't use exam technique properly. And each one of those, you can't revise your way through them. If you didn't know it, you can't revise something you haven't learned. So it's very important if your child has had bouts of absence, and that might even, you know, if you've got a child that's got 95% attendance at school, you probably think that's really good. Over a typical Key Stage 4, that means they've missed 100 hours of learning. That's an awful lot. So it is important if they've had time off to make sure their notes are secure. If they can't recall it, that's on them. No one can remember things for you. And when we look at exactly what revision is, so much of it is about pulling that information out. If they don't understand it, you can't revise your way through not understanding. You have to relearn it. Now, that might be going onto a YouTube explainer, going to a textbook, asking a teacher, but just revising. So every year I would see what was often a girl that had spent hours revising and got terrible results because she didn't understand things. And that's heartbreaking because they've put all the time in, but they don't understand. So you can't revise your way through understanding. And then finally, exam technique, that's where you really need very specific advice. And parents can't hit. They can't say, oh, question two, paper three, you need to hit this assessment objective and you need to do this and you need to do that. That's where they need to go back to their teacher or a specialist tutor and get really specialist advice. So when they don't get the grades they want, quite often a parent's evening, the students will say two things. Don't worry, I'm going to try harder and revise more. That is meaningless. What you need to do is help me go, well, why didn't you get the mark? Is it because you don't know it? Is it because you hadn't revised it and couldn't recall it? Or is it that you didn't understand it or you don't know how to get the marks in the exam? And that kind of coaching with your child will help them really focus between the mocks and the real thing on solving the things that they haven't got.
You've just, oh my God, I can't wait to tell my kids everything you've said. I've made notes and they're going to hear all of this back again, Paul, I can tell you. Well, because you've just laid it bare, really, because everybody's looking for a magic wand, aren't they? They're all trying to figure out what TikTok, what Instagram is going to solve the problems for them. But actually, it involves getting down, learning those four things that you said. You either don't know, you forgot, you didn't understand, or your exam techniques. Like having that as a kind of a framework to know, to isolate what the problem is and then work on the problem is golden. It really is so helpful. And so much of what you said about using the mocks as a diagnostic, that's brilliant. So that's going to be my first port of call. That's where we're going to start the whole conversation. But and about patterns and habits, interleaving the subjects, not less than 20, but no more than 50, and then take a break for 10 minutes. I love the tick list, the dopamine hit. That works for me personally, and I'm not even studying. And the three slots after school, that's really, really helpful. And also, you said it, and I didn't realize, but I suppose I kind of knew it in a way that different subjects revise them in different ways. That is such an important thing to remember as well, because I think children think that, you know, revision is misery. It is misery. It's boring. It's hard. But that you have to do it all the same way. And you clearly don't. You've got to adapt to each subject.
Yes. And it's like that, you know, one of the golden things, every year you'll have a slightly recalcitrant boy that teams up, gets a girlfriend who's very hardworking, and it makes a massive effect because they go home, and rather than playing records or sitting on TikTok, they revise together, and it has a huge impact on that. And actually, sometimes just revising alongside their friends, even if not with them, is a really good motivator. There's also all sorts of apps where if you've got children that are quite driven and they compete against each other. There's one, I can't think what it's called, where they sort of grow a tree and it tells you how you're doing compared to friends. Particularly for some boys, that competitive element really helps drive them. And because revision is essentially quite dull, then finding the ways to both gamify it, so using some of those, occasionally using some of the online resources, is good. It's not the answer. And usually the more fun it is, the less effective it is.
Yeah.
So it is getting that balance between giving yourself those moments when you feel the only good things you can get a satisfaction for a job well done. So even if you've got revision cards, which I'll talk about in a minute, if you start to build, you tick them when you've got them right three times. So when you have, you create a pile, and seeing that pile growing, to physically, visually see this is the progress that I'm making, provides the grain of satisfaction you can draw out of this.
Yeah, brilliant. So let's go back to revision. What is revision and what isn't?
Now, it sounds like a really simple question, but actually this is at the core of where children go wrong. So I say revision is consciously putting information and retrieving information from your head. Now, this is something, so where you really see is that often schools put on revision classes and children sit there for an hour and listen to the teacher reteach something. That is not revision. That is reviewing information. But if they're not consciously putting it and getting it out, practicing that retrieval, then it's not revision. So reviewing is when you're just looking over things that you know. And that is where children go wrong. So if you practice exam questions, then you want to be practicing the retrieval. There are times to do it with an open book and go, oh, I can't remember how to do this. But what you're working on there is if you've got a problem with understanding, it doesn't help you with that retrieval. Revision flashcards are really good, where you have the questions on one side and the answers on the other. It's a great way for parents just to have a little interactive thing. Right, come on, while we're doing the washing up, I'll do this. Right, we'll do a couple. Treat it like a quiz show. Make it Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. There's all sorts of things, but those are a really good way, because the things they prefer, like we all do, are the things that are easiest. So if they go up to revise and they say, what works for me is reading over notes, highlighting notes, writing notes, that is virtually useless.
I'm so glad you said that. So writing, highlighting.
Yes.
Virtually useless.
Virtually useless. Now, it used to send me spare as a head teacher when I would give this advice every year. And then I'd still see students saying, oh, well, this way works for me. And then I found some research that really explained it. Now, what happens is if you've got an exam tomorrow in one subject, then reviewing your knowledge, looking over it, doing a bit of highlighting, rereading your notes will be effective for tomorrow. If you've got an exam in a week's time and you've got two different subjects, it will not be effective. But psychologically, if you do that, the people that do the reviewing of knowledge overpredict, they're overconfident, they overpredict how they'll perform in the exam, because they look over stuff and go, oh yeah, I remember that. Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I remember that. But they haven't practiced getting it out. Whereas people that do retrieval practice, they are very aware of everything. Oh, it was in there, but I couldn't get it out. So they go into the exam and they're underconfident, but they exceed their expectations. So one delivers, but makes you feel worse. The second one makes you feel better, but delivers worse results. So that's really key to understand. And actually, it's no good knowing it. And I always think it's a bit like when you watch TV and you see an actor, you think, I know them from somewhere. And you sit and watch and your brain's ticking away. And eventually, it might be the next day, you go, oh, they were in that film with Brad Pitt. The trouble is, in an exam, you can't go back the next day and do that. So there's a difference between what you know and what is in there and being able to pull it out. Your brain is like a library full of books. But what you've got to be able to do is you've got to be able to find the shelf, the book, the page instantaneously, not just say, oh yeah, it's in there, I know it's in there. And that's all reviewing rather than revising does.
That's so helpful. Really, really helpful. And it hurts, you know, yeah. It's hard, but you just got to get on with it if you want the results you want. If you don't want the results, then it's a different story.
Absolutely.
Brilliant, Paul. So how can we best support our children in the lead up to exams, like in a practical sense and also during the exams? Tell us what's the best thing we can do.
I would say it's really important to avoid, despite your anxieties and worries, what I would call overbearing parenting. So, you know, there's a whole line about we have one mouth and two ears for a reason. And it is really time to grow elephant ears over this time and listen, because then you can respond to where they are. Now, as they're teenagers, quite often anxieties come out in all sorts of ways. And sometimes they're adjacent to the actual problem. So they will start being difficult about different things than they've ever been difficult about before. And at the heart of it are the exams. And I also, it's like the kernel of a nut. You have to talk to that kernel and ignore the noise. You know, they've fallen out with their brother and they don't like this and they want that and making all sorts of demands. But not just responding to that, but just to go, okay, this massively stressful, intense period of their life, which they built up to for, you know, over 10 years of education is coming to a head. And it is going to emotionally unsettle quite a lot of them. So listening to them, first of all, and going, is what they're talking about and what they're worried about really what they're thinking about and worried about? You know, so that slight step back is really good. Being able to tell them with, and it, you know, particularly girls often work themselves to the ground, and that's not helpful either. So actually being able to say, do you know what, enough is enough. This is this guilt-free time off. So actually, if you find your child over revising, and we've said that that doesn't necessarily help, and it's very easy with them then to get overwhelmed with it. They compare themselves to other people. They beat themselves up. They try to revise more. The more they revise, the more they realize they forget, and they whip themselves up into thinking they're not in optimum. You know, even if I'm training for the Olympics, I don't train 12 hours a day in the swimming pool. I do different things. I might do a bit of time in the gym. I might do a bit of a run. I'll do sometimes swimming pool, but then I also have those nutrition and sleep. So making sure they're sleeping properly. It's really important to reiterate that failing exams is not going to be the end of the world. And sometimes educationists, we can get that wrong, and it's guessing the balance. You can't say, oh, they don't matter. And, you know, around exam time, there'll always be celebrities that go on and go, oh, I've only got three GCSEs and look how I've done. They don't matter. Well, when you look at it, they're the exception rather than the rule. And that's great. But you have to make sure that it's not the end of the world. Keeping a narrative up with their teachers in subjects they struggle with, just to make sure things are okay, and bringing in additional help when they need it, if you know, because, you know, most parents, teenagers will know that their teenager knows everything and the adults know nothing. But they will listen to other voices, be that their teachers or tutors or even family friends. Sometimes as a parent, they just dismiss it because when you went to school, everything was vastly different as far as they're concerned. Although revision is essentially the same. So other voices coming in, so it's not you and you're not seen as nagging, helps kind of build credibility with them. But keeping up that dialogue, really simple things about the home, you know, making sure they've got a quiet space, maybe taking them off their chores in exchange for revision. If they don't revise, put them back on the chores. But, you know, showing that there's some concessions, watching those relationships with siblings who might be younger siblings that are irritating them. Also not comparing them to older siblings, because that's a real pressure. And you may be harboring some gentle trauma from that, either, you know, the older brother that completely messed up his exams, or even worse, is the golden child that got amazing exams and you have your mediocre child coming next. And you might feel you're being kind by saying, well, you're a very practical child, but all they hear is you're a bit sick. So actually getting that right. And the key message is this is important, but you're a priority more than anything else. And just let them talk or as much as little about the exams as they want to. And that will naturally keep it as a relaxed dialogue rather than this. They've got enough intensity in their life. They don't need it from home. You need to be a cushion and a blanket, not a stick.
Oh, I've got so many gems now, Paul. I'm going to grow my elephant ears and be a cushion. Sorry, say that one again. A cushion.
Not a stick. Yeah.
Not a stick. I'm going to do my best. Yeah. I balked a bit about letting them off the chores in exchange for study, but I might just give you that one. But yeah, super, super helpful. Right. And let's go to the school now, because I mean, obviously, schools have a pivotal role to play. We as parents have a very big role to play, and we have to do our best. But what should we expect from schools, and what should they expect from us as parents?
Well, I mean, your first point, if we go back to the ways you go wrong, that they've taught all the material, the correct material. Now, if your child's had a lot of teachers, and we know staffing is an absolute nightmare in education, so you may find, particularly in subjects like maths and science, they've got through a lot of teachers. And what can happen sometimes then is that there are gaps in their knowledge. So if your child identifies that, it's worth telling the school, because they might just, if you've got through a lot of teachers and year 11 become your absolute priority in A level, but if you're on your fourth teacher and teacher number three wasn't great and didn't teach a topic properly, it's really hard for the school to track that, because they're just trying to get a specialist in front of your children. So it's worth letting the school know if that comes up. You'd expect the school to furnish them with some revision techniques and provide some, make sure their curriculum does involve, quite most schools will have basic retrieval practice of things right at the start of almost every lesson. They'll build that towards the exam. But school-based revision doesn't replace home revision. And you don't want, if they're doing a revision class after school, and particularly because they can be quite passive, like we've talked about, I can sit there and watch a teacher review the knowledge, and I might get asked a question, but I might not. And I might only get asked one question in an hour because there's another 30 people there. If your child then comes home and goes, yeah, I've done my revision for the day, they haven't. They've been in a room where some knowledge has been reviewed. So it's really important that it's back to that defining what revision is. And it's you on your own quite a lot of the time, putting things and getting things out of your brain. I think having an open dialogue with schools is really helpful. So after the mocks, during parents' evenings, it is a highly pressurized time for schools because they've got A levels, they've got GCSEs, they've got all sorts of things going on. So keeping your communications as short and to the point without being impolite. And most teachers, you know, we want those children to do their best for them, for their futures. So there's not a problem with just asking little questions around that. And what can they expect of you? Well, that you put the child in the driving seat, that you don't expect the teacher to be doing all the revision, and make this is a really important change. Well, you haven't run a revision class. My child, you know, I once got an email in an Easter holiday from a parent telling me that their child wasn't revising, and could I go round to their house and tell the child off and do some revision with them?
Yeah, that's just, I mean, clearly an insane, insane request to put on any teacher. So it's good to remember there are boundaries. And exactly as you say, I mean, it's not, the teachers can't do the revision for the children. It's up to them.
Yes. And actually monitoring what's happening at home and having a sense about it, going to those parents and information evenings and really mining those with your kind of mock, really helping. I would say it's a bit like, you know, when you go to the doctors, they often say, if you go to the hospital, go with somebody else, because sometimes you don't necessarily hear or understand everything right. And that's a great thing with parents' evening. Either you go, you know, take your child along with it, but because otherwise they will interpret, well, she said I couldn't do it. No, she didn't say that. She said this. That's really important because, you know, we all see things through our own perceptions, but particularly teenagers where their brain is very emotionally driven, anything that feels like rejection or criticism can be really helpful feedback. But if what they interpret it as, she said, I've got no, you know, if the teacher has said, you're going to have to work really hard in order to get a grade six because it's impossible, certain children will hear that as, she says, I've got no chance. She said, I can't get a six. So actually making sure that there's two of you, you're hearing it. And then preempting and managing the stress rather than causing them. And quite a lot of the problems we have in schools is where parents are inadvertently whipping up problems, whipping up their child. And then we have to try and deal with the consequences. And you get in this awful loop where you calm the child down and they go home and they come back again. Well, my parents said that. So they feel that they're helping, but they're not. And just trying to keep everything quite calm, all those relationships strong and calm, but putting the child's responsibility at that. They're now 16 or 18. They are in the driving seat of this. And no matter how good your revision as a parent is, you're not sitting the exam for them.
Yeah, it's so helpful to hear you say that, Paul, because, I mean, there is a temptation to heap too much on schools. I mean, they're creating the infrastructure. They're imparting the knowledge. They're giving the exam techniques. They're doing everything they possibly can. But it, as you say, the child is in the driving seat, yeah, or the young adult is in the driving seat, and it's up to them to apply what's been learned.
The only one that can revise, and this is where revision isn't something that is done to you. The only one that can revise is the child. And there can be very frustrating situations where you're with a child and the parents are really on board and you're really on board. But if that child isn't, then, and it's a tough lesson about the accountability, but sometimes they need to learn that. And this is where the mocks are great. A bad set of mock results can be a real shocker and a wake-up call. Interestingly, quite often to complacent, quite bright boys who think they can just breeze through.
Yeah, but that was exactly the situation we had. And it was a wake-up call. And it's actually very, very helpful. But everything you've said now, I mean, I hope parents who are listening, who are kind of, I don't know, struggling like I was, I wish I'd heard this time last year, you know, just where do I even start? What you've outlined really gives a lovely, simple structure to approaching supporting your kids. Paul, thank you so much for all the valuable tips and information that you've given us. And we're not done with you because we've got more questions for you. So tune in next week for the second part of our show with Paul on revision. Thanks a million for joining us.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Elisa Carcar, bringing you honest conversations to support and inspire you as we navigate this wild parenting journey together. Today, I'm joined by Nikki and Mariam, the founders of Root & Bloom. They support mothers through pregnancy, postpartum, and beyond, creating a space where women can feel seen, understood, and less alone. We'll be talking about the realities of modern motherhood, the pressures many women are facing, and an important concept you may not have heard before, matrescence. Welcome, Nikki and Mariam. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us. How exciting. So let's start at the beginning. Could you each introduce yourselves, please, and tell our listeners about what you do, and then also how the two of you met and what led you to create Root & Bloom together?
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm Nikki. I'm a maternal mental health counsellor. So I offer a space for mums to just talk about anything they want pre and postnatally. You know, I also work with women that have experienced pregnancy and infant loss as well. And I got into this because I myself struggled quite a lot with my own mental health before having my son and then at postnatally as well. So I just really want to support women and just validate everything they're going through, because it's really, really tough being a mum. So yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
Yeah, thank you, Nikki. And yes, I'm Mariam and I'm a birth and postpartum doula. I'm quite new to the doulaing world. I sort of came to it after a career of over 20 years in education, most recently as a Senko. And I carry a lot of those skills with me in my doula work, insofar as advocating for people who might not have a voice or be able to advocate for themselves. So a lot of it is very similar in many ways. And why doulaing and why now? Well, my children are a bit older now. And like Nikki, I experienced, you know, challenges when I was going through those early stages of motherhood and myself. And I'd always said if I was going to have a change of career, it's going to be something to do with birth. I didn't know what. I didn't have the brain capacity all the time to go back to uni and do a midwifery degree or anything like that. One of my friends said to me, oh, you know what? Have you ever thought about being a doula? And I thought, actually, you know, I haven't. Let's explore that. So I did my training a few years ago and I've had the honor of, I suppose you could call it informally doulaing for family and friends for a number of years before. And then I've started this and absolutely love it. I'm so glad I made the leap. It just makes sense. And there is so much need out there. Mm. And when Nikki and I first met, we met through a perinatal group of other practitioners and experts in the field. And when we started talking, I sort of, you know, spoke to Nikki about what I see with a lot of the women that I support and the gaps that I feel are really, really prevalent. And Nikki was like, oh my goodness, I see that too. Mm. And it was just very organic. And the way it sort of grew from there about actually with my expertise, with your expertise, mm-hmm. we could create something together. So we just sort of sat down and we had a bit of a brainstorming session. We sort of like, what sort of ideas do we have? And just thought, let's just run with it and see where we land.
Yeah. And because I think there's, you know, even now there's a huge gap. Women have a baby and then it's fine. As long as the baby's fine physically and you're fine physically, off you go. And there's still not much given to actually, how are you feeling? Mm-hmm. Are you okay? At this really, really difficult time. So we wanted to establish Root and Bloom to give women that space where they can talk about these things and feel safe in doing that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, Nikki, you're absolutely right. When you're pregnant and you go for all your antenatal appointments and things like that, it will be about the baby's measurements. It will be about the baby's heart rate. It will be about the baby's growth. Everything is about the baby. Once baby is born, it's again, it's stable. Baby's weight, baby's measurements, baby's, you know, plotting them on their graphs and all of that, which is all super important. Of course it is. But who's talking and holding the mum? Who is checking in with the mum? And that's what we find women are coming to things like Root and Bloom because that's what's missing.
Yeah. And I unfortunately see a lot of women that have dealt with a traumatic birth. It's really not unusual. Mm. But again, if the baby's fine and you're fine physically, then off you go. Yep. And traumatic birth is traumatic, obviously. So there's a lot to process. And that's just one example of, you know, what women deal with. Mm. Never mind everything else. the newness of becoming a mum.
Yeah, absolutely. So from the mothers you're meeting, what kind of things are they really struggling with in early motherhood?
I think the change in identity is a big one that, well, I think we both hear a lot. Just, who am I now? You know, you don't work anymore. You don't just look after yourself or just spend time with your partner anymore. Who am I now? And a lot of women feel a real sense of loss and grief about who they used to be. And it's really hard knowing who you're turning into and the right way of doing things and everything like that. So it's about supporting mums to become the new version of who they are. So a mother, but also still themselves as well.
Yeah. And a lot of those emotions are quite conflicting, right? Because you might love motherhood, you might love your baby, but you might not love this new you.
Yeah.
And, you know, being there for women to unpick that, to just hold that space for them whilst, like you said, figuring out their identity, their new identity. They might not be interested in the stuff they were interested in before. It might be that actually they are, but they don't have the capacity for it anymore. So that landscape shifts from beneath them and they're left all like, oh my goodness, how can we stand up and let alone take a step and continue?
Mm, yeah. And I think there's a big thing about relationship changes as well. Mm. So it's like, who are you now? But also, what's my relationship with my partner like? What's my relationship with my parents like? Because becoming a mother makes you look back in a way, like how you were brought up and also how you want your role as a mother, what you want them to look like as well. And then the practical stuff of, you know, can we just do some of this together? I can't do everything, or, you know, just a lot of those things. So it's navigating changes in relationships, I think, is a big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I hear this a lot in the work that I do as well from mums, just not being connected with their work anymore. Do you think there's a lot of guilt as well surrounding this? Like guilt that I'm complaining, I've got this beautiful baby. Yeah. What have I got to complain about?
Mm.
But actually, it's not complaining, isn't it? It's just, it's voicing this something that doesn't feel right.
Yeah, and it's recognizing it. And sometimes it's validating that for them, isn't it? Guilt is huge in motherhood, in parenthood, no matter where you are on that journey. And I think one of the things that women that I've worked with and they will say they feel guilty for asking for help because they feel they're not bad enough.
Yes.
And there's some magical threshold that says, oh, yes, now you can ask for help because you've reached that threshold. And just saying, well, actually, if anything is different for you or hard for you, that's enough. There is no, you know, there's no set of requirements there that says that, you know, when you can or cannot reach out for help. But yeah, we hear that a lot, don't we?
Yeah.
Oh no, I felt bad for asking for help because I didn't think I was bad enough. You know, or that they feel like, and it's a very female way of thinking. If I ask for help and get help, am I taking it away from somebody else who might be worse than me and need that help more than me?
And also, what does it say about me that I need help? Like, and there are women as well that are like really struggling and but think, will my baby be taken away from me if I bring her? That I'm struggling with my mental health. So, yeah, I think it's definitely, like you said, it's validating, and however you feel is valid, and it's okay to talk about it, and there's support for you, and you deserve that support as well.
And also, like you've identified, there is this gap in support, so women don't know that you can get this sort of support. There's not much of it. I think what you're offering is quite unique, and so it's not commonplace. And like you say, it's either I'm fine or I'm in a really serious state in which I need medical help, you know?
Yeah.
A kind of in-between space is a little bit unoccupied at the moment. But what you're offering, could you tell us more about what a Root and Bloom session would look like? So for somebody who's listening who's never heard of this kind of... is it a group? Is it a community? Is it a sport? How would you describe Root and Bloom?
Yeah, I think all of the above, because it very much is about creating a community and creating that village. You know, it takes a village, right? So that's what we, from the start, wanted to achieve. And we do that through running groups. And we've just finished a series on matrescence, actually, where people are invited to attend one or more session, and we look at different aspects throughout matrescence and all the things that come up. So it covered identity shifts, it covered relationships and setting boundaries, nervous system regulation. There's a whole host of things that we covered. And within those sessions, what I think is really special about what we do is we always make sure we give attendees some tools that they can actually use in real life. So whether that's some grounding techniques, whether that's some positive affirmations, whether it's some scripts when they're practicing setting healthy boundaries and things like that, we make sure that at the end of every session, they leave with something else that they can add to their motherhood toolkit. And we also do coffee mornings, social events and things like that. Now that the weather's getting a little better, we've spoken about maybe doing some walks or some picnics. And, you know, it's very much a space for women to feel held and heard and be part of a community, part of a village. And then obviously, if there is something that they want to speak to either one of us on a one-to-one basis, then they have that option of you know, reaching out and making that connection as well.
Yeah. So like you were just saying, we've done the first matrescence series that finished a couple of weeks ago. And then we've got the next one planned starting in April. So it'll be every other Sunday for 4 weeks. And then we've got a coffee morning coming up this Monday at Megan's from 10 till 12. And that's a bit more of an informal social thing. You're going to be there with little things for the little ones to occupy them, which will be amazing. And then we've got a photographer coming as well. So yeah, so it's like you said, it's just, I think fundamentally, a place for women to meet other women for their village. And then hopefully we can support them with some of our expertise as well.
Yeah. And it's really lovely when we have these group sessions and, you know, one of the women might say something, you know, share something that they might be finding challenging or a question. And it's beautiful to be able to sit back sometimes and watch one of the other mums then give that person support or advice or say, actually, this is what worked for me, or have you tried this? And it's like, oh, you know, we can see that community forming. We can see them exchanging numbers and saying, oh yeah, I don't live far, maybe we could meet up for a coffee sometime, or, you know, etc. And again, because there's women there who are pregnant, they are newly postpartum, or even further on in their motherhood journeys, it's relevant to everyone, honestly. So having them exchange those little moments of support within, you know, amongst themselves, I think that's really special.
Yeah,
definitely. And that's, you can see that village becoming.
Yeah, yeah.
Wonderful. And can the mothers bring their little ones if they can't get childcare?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because we understand, you know, and we don't want to exclude people because they don't have childcare. That would be ridiculous of us to say that, given what we're trying to do. So, yeah, definitely.
And we take into account when we're looking for venues to run anything, you know, will they have baby changing facilities? Will it be suitable to bring a pushchair in? You know, all those things. We've both, you know, been there, done that, got the t-shirt and can understand how challenging it can be leaving the house with a newborn baby, especially in those first few weeks. So we try and think of as much as we can to make it as comfortable of an experience as possible.
Yeah.
And kind of from the mums that you've had coming along so far, is it mums with children of all different ages, or does there seem to be a particular time in which this help is being sought out?
We've had pregnant women, we've had first-time mums with young babies, we've had women that are pregnant, but it's not necessarily their first pregnancy. So, yeah, it's just a real range of mums, really.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, wonderful. And you mentioned the word matrescence, and I just wanted to explore that a little bit because that's a word that many people won't know listening in. So could you describe what it means and why you think it's important that we should be talking about this?
Yeah, of course. It was actually a word that was coined in the 1960s. So it was a long time ago. I can't remember the lady's name who created it. But anyway, basically what it is, it's the physical, psychological, physiological, emotional change that you go through when you become a mother. So it's called matrescence because it's a similar idea to adolescence, because obviously that's another big time in your life when things are changing. I think it's really important for women to understand it because I think it, again, it's about validation, about how hard it is, about all these different changes and all different ways, you know, emotionally and physically. And it's just giving a name to it. And even just over the past week or so, there's been more talk about it online through Peanut. And they're pointing out, which has frustrated me as well, that when you write the word matrescence, a red wiggly line comes up. So it's not even in the dictionary. They're trying to get it in the dictionary. You know, it's just another thing of, oh, well, it's a mum thing, they'll deal with it, it doesn't need any of this. But I think giving the word and the definition to how hard this is, and again, whatever you're feeling is normal, because every mum goes through it, I think it's really important that mums can understand that.
Yeah, please, that validation, like you keep saying, so important. And if there's a mum listening right now who's feeling overwhelmed or alone, what would you want to say to her? And how can she find out more about what you're offering, and how can she contact you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first thing that we would say is, whilst it might feel you're alone, I absolutely promise you that you're not alone. And I think rather than look for women who are also feeling the same and making those connections, I think they can start with just meeting women, full stop. Because like Nikki's just said, matrescence is applicable probably to, I'm going to say it, to every mother, no matter where you are in that season of motherhood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking for other women is enough for you to begin with, to start making those connections. And then when you made a connection, you start speaking to people, you realize that actually there are so many things that they are finding difficult or challenging that I can relate to, and vice versa. So you've already got this shared experience. So I'd say, yeah, you're definitely not alone. And as hard as it is to get out the house, but, you know, finding communities, even if it's an online community where you can speak to other mums. And I think there are some great apps out there now and you know, WhatsApp communities or Instagram and things like that, where you can speak to other mums on, you know, on that sort of interface. But meeting them face to face is one step more, right? That's actually a human need, that connection. It's what's really necessary. Find out more about Root and Bloom via our Instagram, which is Root and Bloom St. Albans, with some dots in between.
Yeah.
And you know, on there is where we post any upcoming events, whether it's coffee mornings or our matrescence series and things like that. You can also follow us on Eventbrite. Again, it's Root and Bloom St. Albans. We're looking to get a website set up, but we're in the early stages of that. But again, any information regarding that will be on the Instagram as well.
I'm just going to put my counsellor hat on and just say as well, if there's a mum out there who's feeling particularly overwhelmed and really, really struggling, the best thing to do is go to your GP and chat to them about it. Yeah, because we are just there for a bit of emotional support. We're not, you know, we're not replacing any sort of medical advice, obviously, or anything like that. So just in case, I mean, there could well be mums out there who are really struggling, and just know that wherever you go, there is support.
Nikki and Mariam, thank you so much for joining me today and for the work you're doing to support mothers in our community.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to The Parent Show on Mix 92.6. Today, I was joined by Nikki and Mariam from Root and Bloom, talking about supporting mothers through matrescence and helping women feel less alone in early motherhood. You can find out more about their work and how to contact them through their social media and their local group sessions and meetups. I'm Elisa Carcar, and I'll be back next time with more honest conversations to support and inspire you on your parenting journey. Until next time, take care.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.